So then it's going to set it to another payload. And so you can like, oh, wow, we just found a vulnerability in Kaido. That's really funny and really cool. This will definitely be fixed by the time it goes live, but that's hilarious. I'm actually going to send that right now to the team.
All right, hackers, here's the deal. Before you skip forward, give me like 2 seconds to give you a takeaway. Okay, here it is. Threat Locker Detect is the best EDR around. They have a ton of tool integrations. The alerts are high signal, so you're not swimming in a bunch of garbage. And both alerting and remediation actions are super customizable. It's definitely the one you want. Okay, that's it. Skip forward if you must, but I do feel like you should know why I think that, right? Well, we've talked a lot about the Threat Locker suite, and frankly, they're the best implemented tools around from a technical perspective. With the CDR, they're focusing a lot on customization and high signal stuff like PowerShell activity, log deletion, sketchy RDP sessions, stuff that I have wished many times EDRs were not detecting actively, okay? And while it does work out of the box, it also gives you, the experienced purple teamer, the tools you need to implement custom logic to lock hackers out of your network at the first sign of trouble. That trouble is the trouble that you are most qualified to recognize, so they're equipping you to deal with it right away. They're definitely the ones you guys want to go with if you're looking for a new EDR tool. All right, that's it. Let's go back to the show. Sup, hackers. Got the This Week in Bug Bounty segment for you. First up is this NullCon Berlin live hacking event that is being run by Yes We Hack. This is just around the corner, September 4th through 5th, and it seems like a really great opportunity. The way that Yes We Hack runs these live hacking events is they reveal the target the day of. I do have a little piece of insight that it is a big company known all over the world. It's open to all NullCon participants. So if you're hitting that up in Germany, then definitely check out the live hacking event with Yes We Hack. Next is also something from Yes We Hack, the Bug Bounty Bulletin, which is something that I wasn't really on my radar until just a week ago. But apparently it's like pretty big. It's got like 17,000 subscribers on LinkedIn, and it is Yes We Hack's sort of weekly newsletter. Got some great content in there. Oh, what is this? Is this critical thinking? Oh, how did that get in there? So funny. This is another great place to get news on Bug Bounty stuff. So certainly check it out. They talk about Kaido, a new Kaido video, another live hacking event Yes We Hack ran. It's looking like a good roundup. All right, last but not least, we've got Grab with HackerOne. Grab has been running their program for 10 years. And as a result, they're doing an anniversary promotion, which is a 2x bounty multiplier from August 11th to September 10th. Okay, so definitely going to want to check that out. Also, just check out the stats for this program. 3 hours to first response, 3 days to triage, 6 days to bounty. That is like S-tier response time. And they're doubling their bounties, and they've got a massive scope. So this is looking like an amazing program that I've been sleeping on. You guys should definitely check it out too. All right, that's it for the This Week in Bug Bounty. Let's get back to the show.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Critical Thinking Podcast. Joseph Rezzo this time, and I'm interviewing the great Jack Cable, and I'll get into his intro in a minute, but first we'll kick it off with a bug, of course. So Jack, you just teased it to me and I'm pretty excited about it. So what bug did you bring for us today?
Awesome. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. Great to be on the podcast. Yeah, so the one that I've got for today is a fun one, right? That this relates to Cluely, which I imagine that people might be familiar with. You know, they've gotten a decent amount of attention lately. And this was maybe a month or so ago. I was poking around on their desktop app. Found a number of things which we can probably get into later around understanding their system prompt, things like that. But the interesting bug was I was looking into essentially seeing if there were ways to compromise the desktop application. And I saw a few things, right? Because it's an Electron app and they were loading in basically, you know, essentially takes a screenshot of your computer, sends it off to their server, which sends it to OpenAI or Anthropic, and it kind of renders the response from their server as Markdown. So that got me interested, right? And of course, with Electron apps, since they're just, you know, websites, basically, if you can get cross-site scripting, that can be pretty severe. And the interesting thing here is that I noticed, one, they weren't using the Electron sandbox, and two, I noticed that if you were able to, say, get a link to be displayed, and then the user clicks that, opens it up, It turns out they were passing quite a bit of context to that new website. And in particular, there were a number of post-message handlers available that would essentially receive messages right from the application. I think this is probably intended for, like, internally, right, because they want to do things like take screenshots or update different permissions. But what I don't think they anticipated was that any website that was opened in Clearly could access this, and In particular, probably the most dangerous one, right, was they had a function to take a screenshot. So I tested that out, and takes a screenshot of your screen, unsurprisingly, but that's pretty bad to give any arbitrary website the ability to do. So essentially, right, I rigged up a POC where I just continually took a screenshot of the person's computer. So effectively, you're now recording their screen, and all they have to do is click a link. So
what
that
you should
was,
have done is given that to Amazon. So when anyone was using Clearly in interviews, it was actually monitoring the interviewee screen, right? It's like a reverse Clearly.
Exactly.
They think they're getting away with cheating on the interview, but actually Amazon's just monitoring their screen the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. You're the one who's being recorded instead. So,
right.
So, that was a fun one. I disclosed it to them. They did fix it quickly.
Did any of the post message allow for XSS? Because where it's an Electron app, that could have just been RCE, right?
So, I was also looking for XSS or things like whether kind of input from that would go into a system command. Beyond that, there wasn't a ton of attack service. There were functions, for instance, like request microphone access, things like that, but nothing that necessarily took in input.
But still, I mean, pretty bad. Screenshots of the desktop is basically leaking any secrets and anything else. So that's cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Sweet, dude. Good find. Well, I will now intro you since you're appropriately christened here. For anybody who doesn't know who Jack Cable is, he was a very top bug hunter. I think he has like 10,000 rep on HackerOne, and was kind of around the live hacking scene and stuff for a little bit, but has since started a company called Corridor.dev. Did you do anything in between those two things? Like, did you have a company before Corridor?
So I was actually working in government before this, and that was a lot of the reason, cool. You know, that I stopped doing bug bounty as much, because as it turns out, when you're working in government, you can't really get income from outside sources. Mm. So spent a couple years working in the Senate for 1 year, writing legislation around things like open source software security. And then what was at CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, for 2 years, leading on the Secure by Design initiative. So did a lot to try to get tech companies to improve their software security.
Yeah, that's awesome. Did being involved deeper than any of the rest of us are make you more hopeful, or kind of like less hopeful for a positive change in that way? Like, do you think that being a part of government, and then also even more than just being a part of, like, you know, a specific agency, but like also just being involved in the legislation process, was that like disheartening, or was it actually like not that bad?
I think there's some of both, right? Where the time I was in the Senate, for instance, was a very productive time kind of around cybersecurity legislation. There was a lot of bipartisan support, that there still is some today, but it may be a little less so. And so saw a lot of kind of positive momentum. And likewise, being at CISA, found that when you're in the right place in government, kind of when appropriately empowered, there's a lot that can be done. So did a bunch of work to get commitments from companies, for instance, to improve their product security. One of the elements, for instance, this was the Secure by Design pledge, was to operate a vulnerability disclosure policy. So tried to really kind of strengthen the role of security research. So I think there are opportunities to have some large scale impact here. Of course, change doesn't happen overnight, but I do think it's important for you know, technical people to be in the room, because ultimately,
100%.
You need to understand how things work under the hood.
What is that like VDP or VR or VRP thing that Casey Ellis kind of started? Did
disclose.io?
Yeah. Was that at all like an inspiration or useful to you guys in that whole
thing? Certainly.
Yeah.
So now I got involved with disclose.io a while ago when it was starting out. I think definitely a lot of that momentum kind of helped to underpin a lot of the work that got done, where, you know, now we're in a point where it is really the norm to operate a vulnerability disclosure policy, right? That's sort of the bare minimum for a company who wants to be responsible around security. Of course, even better to go incentivize research with a bug bounty. But at the baseline, you need to have a way to take in reports from hackers. And a lot of the work that Casey and I did as well was around advocating for legal safe harbor to give these assurances that a company won't take legal action against you. So that work was really essential. And a lot of what I focused on in government, right, was kind of helping to continue to make this the norm, and make it the expectation that companies would, that's in the pledge language, is also to have safe harbor within their vulnerability disclosure policy.
To basically reduce friction there to deploy it a lot like easier, or because no company's going to do it if it's a heavy lift to actually, like, you know, put those terms and those agreement out there. But if it's like a one click or like, here, just put this on your website, then all of a sudden it becomes really feasible, right?
Exactly.
Cool. Well, one thing I wanted to do was like talk kind of practically about AI stuff. Obviously, it's kind of what people expect me to talk about, but it's also what I love and I find enjoyable. So I guess kind of two things. One, I was going to see when did it click for you, or when did like, what kind of opened your eyes or made you find kind of AI AppSec more interesting? And then two, like, you know, what have you been doing in that field or kind of pressing into? And obviously core.dev has a little bit of that to say there, but let's start with that first question. What exactly got you where you were like, wow, what was the eye-opening kind of moment for the mixture of AI and security, whether it's from the offensive side of things or the defensive side of things?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was really twofold. So one, and through the course of the work at CISA, right, as well as just my time doing bug bounties, saw kind of just how much companies were struggling with product security. And as you know, right, often it's the very basic vulnerabilities that slip through and cause a lot of impact, cause a lot of harm, and kind of just got me thinking, okay, there has to be a better way. And then really what I think kind of made me realize there's a lot of opportunity here was just using these tools for development. So using Cursor, Claude Code, some other tools, and seeing kind of just how capable they are. Of course, they all have their limitations, but like as a software developer, these tools have helped me work, I don't know, 5-10 times as fast. And kind of I try to, you know, go code something without one of these tools now, I'm just going to be so much slower. So kind of got me thinking, okay, if AI is this good at understanding code, writing code, it must be quite capable as well around aspects like vulnerability discovery, as well as other workflows within application security. That was starting point. Yeah,
I made that same leap in my head, but I don't know if that was intuitively true, or like, I don't know if it was intuitive to everyone else when that first kind of popped off, right? Like, it makes complete sense, but it is kind of interesting how like the theory of mind works for humans versus like people who are familiar and intimate kind of with like LLMs today and what they're expecting that other LLMs would be capable of, even just like the theory of mind of a brain that's working off of tokens instead of like our brains, which can see both words or characters and can like parse them both independently and uniquely and how LLMs kind of parse things via tokens. And like being able to have theory of mind for what the AI might see with like how it's viewing the world in tokens instead of viewing it with characters versus words is like very interesting to me. And so I think that's kind of like a similar thing you did there where you basically understood that, hey, if this thing's good at development, it's also processed all the PRs and all the security fixes across all of GitHub as well. So it probably also knows what vulnerabilities look like and how to exploit them and that sort of thing. So that's cool. And so then like, what exactly are you all building with Corridor.dev?
Yeah, so really the focus with Corridor, right, is building kind of applying AI to help product security teams. And I'd say it's really a full range of the work that they do. So it's both around kind of better enabling vulnerability discovery and really building up the kind of context of a code base. But then it's tying this into kind of every stage of the development process. So we talk to product security teams who almost, you know, universally are overwhelmed. They have too much work to do. Their existing like stack analysis tools are surfacing, I don't know, like 90% plus false positives. They don't have time to go through those. Developers don't have time. And they're also missing the vulnerabilities that actually matter. So what we're focusing on is really enabling these product security teams to multiply their work, just like, you know, Curse or other tools have totally changed the game of software development, but in many ways it feels like security teams are still living in the past with their tooling. So it's around capitalizing on these advancements to kind of help product security teams review every pull request, be able to take all the, you know, bug bounty reports that they're getting, act on them more quickly. Those sorts of workflows that I think are really underexplored.
Yeah, that's awesome. When you were doing bug bounty, what was kind of your bread and butter? What type of vulnerabilities were you like typically finding more of versus the other ones?
So it was a mix. I think probably the most interesting, kind of most frequent ones were authorization vulnerabilities. Yeah. And, you know, some of them can be quite simple IDORs where you just change an ID and it gives you all sorts of sensitive information. Others could be kind of a little more kind of complicated business logic things. But I think those were really some of the more impactful vulnerabilities that I reported over the years. And there are some interesting ones too, kind of like right when I was getting into bug bounties. This was when I was like 15 or 16. Some of the kind of initial things I was looking for were race conditions. And did this especially on like cryptocurrency websites where it would basically go to everyone and see, okay, can I like withdraw money multiple times? Can I kind of do other actions that would allow me to basically steal money if I want to, and found a number of those vulnerabilities that I disclosed. There was one exchange where I think like I could have drained their wallet of like 100K or something in Bitcoin if I had wanted to. So a lot of those types of flaws that, you know, might kind of go missed without more extensive testing.
Yeah, that's interesting because that was back before the BERT plugin for race condition specific tests, right? Like the last backend attack was before that. Yeah. Do you remember how you were doing it?
Yeah. I mean, I still do this and works a good amount of the time. Basically just, you know, doing burp copy as curl and then opening a terminal, sending off multiple requests in parallel. So I'm sure, doesn't
catch all the things that the, too.
The burp extension probably has a better detection rate, but at least for a lot of these things where, you know, it's not like instantaneous operation, it can do quite well. Yeah, I think this is like when I was like 15, I read this blog post of someone who had done this in like Starbucks or something. And I was like, wow, I should really start testing this out. And it worked quite a bit.
There's so many cool little small bug classes like race conditions or like the most recent episode that just aired today, as we're recording this, July 24th, Justin interviewed Matthias, and he, it's all about archive attacks. I don't know if you saw it in your feed yet, but it's like really neat. It's basically like a bunch of, you know, variations of the old like zip slip attacks, but you know, just new variations of it. And, you know, obviously awesome. Pretty big impact. It's neat the way that there are so many like little tiny niches. Cool. Yeah. So coming back to the quarter-audit dev thing, one thing that I thought was interesting was I think you tweeted or saw about it, and that it was actually in one of your congressional speaking things. You're basically like, you know, AI is going to write, you know, plenty of vulnerabilities. And I found that to definitely be true in my kind of vibe coding in the last few months. But I'm also like, yeah, but so are plenty of like novice developers, right? Like, before vibe coding, bug bounty was lucrative because humans write lots of vulnerabilities. And so like, it doesn't change the game too much. Like it's like, it's almost independent of AI writing vulnerabilities that AI prodsec would actually be useful, right? It's like, even if we didn't have vibe coding, this would still be a very high utility tool.
Yeah. So to me, what's really interesting, right, is that a lot of how I think about it is in terms of volume and scale. And we know that these AI development tools are allowing developers to write code much faster than ever before, much higher volumes. Mm-hmm. We also know that's enabling people who have never coded before to go and, you know, vibe code a website or something like that. So I think it does, to your point, just continue expanding the attack surface. Where I'm less worried about, you know, novel vulnerabilities getting introduced from a vibecode app, but it's more about, okay, these models are going to introduce the same types of flaws that we've known about for decades that humans haven't been able to root out, that are going to continue to give us problems. And I had the chance to testify to Congress. This was maybe a month or two ago at Stanford. And a lot of the focus was around kind of how AI was affecting security. One of the things I mentioned there is there's this benchmark called Daxbench, which looks at how well LLMs do at writing secure code, and found, maybe unsurprisingly, that even the best models, about 20 to 30% of the time, do introduce vulnerabilities, right? And they can often can be, you know, basic things like SQL injections, XSS. I've had, like, when using models myself, it's like adds a command injection vulnerability or something. And if you tell it, like, okay, write a secure command execution, then it'll do it securely, but otherwise it won't. So it's things like that these models are introducing. And especially when it gets to things like business logic flaws, I think that's where a lot of the, you know, vulnerabilities in vibecode apps that we'll see will originate, because again, that requires kind of the person who's behind the wheel, who's using these tools, to actually understand the security model. And as we allow people with less and less experience to build these apps, I think the attack surface is just going to kind of continue to balloon.
Yeah. Same kind of story there for, you know, human like coders, or I guess what I'm trying to say is like, you know, big companies with big budgets have had static code analysis tools for a long time, right? It's going to find the places where you might have code injection, or where you might have XSS, or where you might have a SQL injection, but the business logic flaws and, you know, permission issues, like RBAC permission issues, are just like never going to be found by static analysis, or probably even like lots of times from code review, because it just requires the app to actually be running to test a lot of those things, right? So yeah, that's really interesting. I think that the very final form there will hopefully eventually be solved by hackbots, right? Because it really does need to have like live testing on top of something like Corridor. Or what I don't understand why this hasn't existed yet, I hope with the GitHub release and GitHub Spark this week that they'll eventually release it, but I don't understand why GitHub doesn't have automatic security PR reviews. It's just like, it's ripe for the taking. It's right there. I would pay a subscription for it. Every company would, if like every PR you put out just had an automated security, like, wow, what's it called? Code review.
Yeah, 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 exactly. That's something we've been doing and found that can work quite well. And to your point, I think especially when it comes to authorization type bugs, that's not something you're going to be able to find with static analysis. It's something that you need to actually understand mm-hmm. how the application works and operates. And you see this a lot with these zero code, vibe coded sites. A lot of them use Supabase or Firebase for the database and have pretty secure configurations, but the aspect that can go wrong, right, that you can't just tell hard code or prevent by default is when it comes to permissions. Because with Supabase, for instance, you need to define authorization policies for who can access what. Right. And securely doing that is not a trivial problem. So it's areas like that I think are really going to be the long tail that, to your point, AI can help us to understand how an application works. But I think as one law in security, that it's that as the amount of code grows, as the complexity of code grows, that the number of vulnerabilities increases by quite a bit. So I think we'll just see more of that.
Yeah, and honestly, I had never thought about this before, but the fact that vibe coding kind of breaks down at a certain size is a good thing for security right now, because it's still manageable to kind of code review it and to find those little vulnerabilities. Whenever it can go slightly longer horizon, if you were to let, for example, Gemini 2.5 Pro output, a 500,000 token app, chance for vulnerabilities is way higher, like you said, because the more complexity and the more code, the more likely there are to be vulnerabilities. And so, and these coding systems are going to keep improving, right? Right now it's the worst it'll ever be, as they always say. Yep. So as these systems in the next year or two ramp up to being able to build much more complex apps, there's going to be many more vulnerabilities. The other thing I thought about that you mentioned on the permissioning thing with Supabase, because I do think that's a big deal, is do you know if Supabase is able to be deployed via Terraform in the same way you can do GitHub repos? Such that you can manage permissions with configuration files, because when you're adding new members to a new organization and GitHub or whatever, if you've got it all deployed via Terraform or something, you can actually manage those permissions in the file. And I think that would make LLMs much better than them having to use the UI or UX, right, of Supabase.
Yeah. I think that is what many of these vibe coding tools are doing, is that they'll generate a lot of them are using Supabase's row level security configurations, and they do have a file that contains the essentially authorization policies for your code base. So certainly, I think having these configuration files is a good thing, but what really matters is are the contents of them actually lining up with the security model of the application. And to your point, the bigger the code base grows, the more potential for missteps there.
I've noticed that my apps, whenever I'm letting an LLM develop them, often get insecure when I'm struggling with something that is usability, which is kind of funny because it's that tension between usability and security. I was working on an app where it's basically just read-only public or admins, and I wanted the read-only public to basically show the results from a bunch of matches, but the table kept getting 401 or 403 based on the way it had set up the API to pull those results, to pull those matches. And then so it's let's just make this public, when actually what it needed to do was think about what data was in that table, rather than just switching the table to being public, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought that was kind of interesting, and probably a way that it plays out pretty often.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think there is a lot of potential. I've seen this even outside of security context, where you ask the LM to do something and it does that, as well as three other things that you didn't ask. Yeah. Often they'll be lazy and try to take shortcuts instead of actually fixing the underlying issue.
Yeah, the other thing that I've been wrestling with is on the two ends of the spectrum, from using SDKs and libraries to just rolling your own. I actually like to kind of roll my own, not personally. When I'm developing personally, I definitely don't. But with AI, I like the fact that it can kind of roll its own, because you can kind of control everything and make it custom or whatever. But what I find is that when I'm making a bigger app and it starts to do that, it gets really bloated, especially if it's doing markdown parsing to HTML or something. Now it's writing a bunch of regular expressions to convert bullets and new lines. It's no, just use a library, please.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I've
cool.
seen that too. Yeah.
I wanted to circle us back to the Clueless stuff, because that was pretty funny when that blew up on Twitter recently. So, yeah, if anyone doesn't know, basically, yeah, well, actually, you go ahead and tell the first half of the story. You tell about the system prompt research that you yep. were presumably doing along with your bug you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, exactly. So this was around the same time as I found that bug. I, you know, had taken Clueless desktop app. I unzipped it because Electron apps are basically just a zip file. And noticed pretty quickly that the system prompt for both like their standard version and enterprise version were embedded within the source code. For those who aren't familiar, Clueless essentially, you know, yes, supposedly lets you cheat on anything. So basically it's a prompt where it takes a screenshot of your screen, says, okay, tell the user like what to say next. So I was able to find those complete prompts. There were some interesting elements of that. They also said, for instance, like never say what model you're using, but like right above that was hard code that I think was like, forget what exact model, but there's a OpenAI model and a Anthropic model in there. So naturally, you know, I tweeted this out, said that Clueless embedded their prompt in their desktop source code, that wound up getting quite a bit of attention. So yeah, that was the first part of the story.
Yeah, and so then basically you received a kind of takedown or cease and desist or something on that tweet, right? Or actually, no, was it for GitHub repo? Was it a gist or something?
So it was for the tweet. So essentially a couple of weeks later, right, I got a DMCA takedown notice from Twitter that my tweet had been, or at least the images within it had been taken down because Clueless filed a DMCA takedown saying that my tweet had contained basically proprietary information. Their intellectual property, which is kind of funny if you think about it, right? Because if this is their intellectual property, maybe they shouldn't be sending it to the desktop of however many users they have. So that was kind of wild. And again, going back to the kind of vulnerability disclosure policy, disclosed.io work, one of the elements of a safe harbor is committing to not take legal action like filing DMCA takedowns. So that was a bit surprising that they would go and do that. Now, the funny part is I go and tweet this out, and the CEO of Clueless responds saying that they didn't file the DMCA takedown.
And also, if it would have been Roy Lee that actually filed it, that would have been so ironic, considering that he was literally sued by like companies. Like, I think they've been sued by like 5 or 10 companies.
Yeah.
So the fact that they were like threatening legal action is just like so ironic and crazy.
Yeah. So he said they didn't do it, and he also like posts a screenshot of his conversation with his lawyer around it. That also was strange, since the DMCA takedown notice had the information of the Clueless employee who filed that. So I posted that, I tagged the employee, and he admitted, you can see it on Twitter, that he had done this, that, you know, he apologized, that he didn't check with Clueless leadership. And then Roy also apologized after that. The funny part is, so yeah, he retracted it, though the tweets are still down, the images,
You go,
they still haven't been restored, so working on that. But the other fun part is that Roy had offered to compensate me. I said, how about instead you donate to the EFF? So he wound up donating about $1,000 to the EFF, so at least something.
Ah, that's cool. Yeah, that's really cool. Good on him. I was messaging him initially when they first like kind of got started and stuff, and we were messaging a little bit, but I don't think that he likes me too much anymore. I basically was just like sharing some other vulnerabilities they had at the very beginning, and he was like, no, it's not vulnerable. And then when it came out, it was super vulnerable. I was like, I told you so. And then he hated that. So, but anyways, yeah, that's funny and cool. And I think that if anything, they probably viewed that as like free media attention with the way that they run their company. So I don't think that he was actually bothered by that at all, right? Yeah. Cool. Yeah. So I do think you would maybe be a good person to talk about this. This is a little bit of a hot take. I personally don't think that there's a lot of risk these days for a known bug hunter to hack on things that they do not have permission to hack on. And from being on the legislative side and, you know, working at CISA and also being like a reasonable, ethical, moral person, I would be interested in your thoughts on that. And I think we could kind of break this down into two categories. One is, let's say, testing with your own accounts. So I know because of that, like, Supreme Court's recommendation, I think testing with your own accounts is, like, most people think that that actually is probably fine, or at least the people that I kind of talked to about this. And then let's say another situation where, like, you don't have two accounts and you can't get two accounts because it's, like, tied to your identity or something, and you still want to vet the application for your own usage. So it is still, maybe there's three categories. Sorry to make this confusing. So One is you're testing an app that you're using and you have two users and you only test your users you own. Two is you're testing an app that you do actually use and you can claim that you're, like, actually wanting to test it for your own usage, for example, but you don't have a second account and you want to check for things like, you know, that would disclose other people's information like IDOR or whatever else. And then the third category we'll say is apps that you actually don't use and you have no right to be testing on. So, like, you're trying to hack F1 or, you know, you're trying to hack the NBA, right? Like, but they don't have bug bounty programs or VDPs. And so I still, you know, I don't do it. I have a wife and three children and, you know, my risk tolerance is low, so I don't do it. But I still talk to people and I basically tell people that I think that the real true risk of legislation coming, if you're willing to disclose whatever you find responsibly, is basically infinite, like approaching zero these days. Especially if you have a reputation with the you know, bug bounty platforms or whatever. So give me your take on those three things.
So yeah, super interesting topic. And of course, I'll start this by saying I'm not a lawyer. Please, sure. Anyone yeah, listening, don't take this as legal advice. So the current state of things. So one, in terms of what is legally okay, is one, if you are testing something that you have locally. So for instance, like in this Clueli scenario, right, this was their desktop application. I was testing on my computer. In the past, like decades ago, companies would bring, you know, kind of legal action under, say, DMCA against researchers saying you didn't have the right to reverse engineer that program. We now have, there's a security research exemption in the DMCA. So if you're doing good faith security research, then you are allowed to test something locally. Now, where it does get a lot fuzzier is when that application isn't, you know, hosted yourselves, but it's someone else's application.
If it's client-side JavaScript, are you, like, I guess technically allowed to probably look at that part, but you can't test for server-side vulns or something?
So, if you can read
letter of the law.
Yeah. You can essentially, you know, reverse engineer the client-side JavaScript or, like, desktop application, or if you get, I don't know, like, the binary of an application or something like that. Where it gets fuzzier in the U.S. is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, CFAA, says essentially any unauthorized access to a computer system is illegal unless you have specific permission to test it. That's where, again, right, having a VDP or a bug bounty program, which proactively is a company saying, hey, we want you to test this. Here are the rules that you can follow. Ideally, they'll have a safe harbor to say we commit to not taking legal action. But that's the reason that's so important, right, is that's providing authorization for you to go and test a system. In the absence of that, right, in your examples, technically anything that you do could be considered to be unauthorized access and violating CFAA. Now, to your point, like if you are testing on your own account, if you find something, if you responsibly disclose it, it's unlikely that a company would choose to take legal action against you, but it's always a possibility. And like I've experienced in my own instances, you know, outside of Clueli, where there have been investigations, and fortunately haven't had anything happen. But I do think there are still risks, unfortunately. That's why I think it is really positive that we have so many more companies having VDPs. Mm-hmm. I've also done a bunch of work to get state governments to operate vulnerability disclosure policies. Federal government now, every federal agency has one. So we're making a lot of good progress. And then we also have, so Department of Justice a couple of years ago put out an updated sentencing policy to say essentially they wouldn't sentence people for CFA violations where they deem it's good faith security research. Mm-hmm. So we're in a bit of a better place, but I think still a lot of work to be done to make this something that you can, you know, truly go and do good faith security research without having to worry at all about legal action.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you're saying that you actually do think there is more legal action brought against people, or at least threatened legal action against people, than maybe gets publicized? Because I basically never see it.
I think so. And it's not like I'm not saying it's super common, but personally, I've experienced it. I know other friends who have. And right, even if like,
I mean, size of you and some friends would be enough to convince me that it were common, because
and even short of, you know, like actually getting, I don't know, sentenced or convicted of a crime, there's all sorts of kind of things that go into to legal cases, and you know, sure, lawyers are notorious for
not cheap,
not being cheap. So I think it is still a real consideration. Certainly we're better off now than we were 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, but I think that there's certainly room to go.
Yeah. Cool. Sweet. Are you going to be at DEF CON?
I will be. Yeah. Excited to be heading back there. We're going to be sponsoring B-Sides this year. Cool. And then, yeah, I'll be hanging out around on DEF CON as well.
Nice, dude. Well, I don't typically do this, since we're not too late on time at all. Do you have any like thoughts or questions for me, or any like kind of just, you know, we were talking before we kind of started here. We're both joining like a kind of a smaller potential contract based like red team thing. Is there any red team topics or anything that's interesting to you that you've kind of heard about or thought about lately?
I mean, I'd love to hear just like how you've been using AI in your own testing. Like what have you found most effective? What's your kind of day-to-day workflow?
Cool. Yeah. I think this episode will go out late enough where this is fine to talk about. And if it, based on our content calendar for the pod, it looks like it'll go out maybe plenty late. Yeah. 1:39. Okay, cool. Yeah. So this will definitely be out by then. So I can definitely share this. So me and Justin and Bebix have been working in Kaido. You know, you probably heard of our app Shift.
Yep.
Which was fine. It didn't do, you know, crazy well or anything, but you know, Kaido, wanted to, you know, really take on more of like an AI perspective. And so, there is a really cool Shift agents thing that we're dropping that I will share my screen about. Let me find a safe project. Actually, let me just make a new temp project. But what it is, and Justin's been talking about this for a while, it's called Shift Agents. So I will start a new project, create project, test, create. All right, yeah, so check this out. Sorry for audio listeners. I'll describe what I'm doing in case you're watching, but where's the share button? Here it is. So share, screen, window, Kaido. So in Kaido, basically there's just going to be the thing called Shift Agents. And what's really cool is we have some built-in system prompts for things like XSS testing, SSRF testing, path traversal, SQL injection, and then you can add custom prompts here. And how these are used by the agents is really cool. So let's say you send this request to replay, and here in replay, you want to like test for XSS in this parameter, let's just say, you know, XSS, or actually input, you know, whatever. So you can, this is switching to WebSockets. Mm-hmm. Let's use a better request. So I'll use this request. So this is just some random request that was automatically populated by Google. So you can open this agent, And then you can choose what prompt. Cool. So if you want to check for XSS here, you can say like, try and find XSS in the ATIP param. All right, cool. So basically in Shift Agents, you go in, you put your API key here, you validate it. And then here in replay, these agents will just like work on your behalf. So you can say like, yep, find an XSS in ATIP for me. And it like, you know, there's like the thinking, yep, blob where it's talking about what you're talking about. And then, so right now it's asking for clarification, the first query param. And so what it does is it will modify the payload, send it, modify the payload, send,
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Let's see if it's working. Yeah. So it modified it to this, then it sent it. Then it's like looking and saying like, oh, 400 byte request. So let's try something else. So then it's going to set it to another payload. And so you can, yep, like, oh, wow, we just found a vulnerability in Kaido. That's really funny and really cool. This will definitely be fixed, yeah, by the time it goes live, but that's hilarious. I'm actually going to awesome. Send that right now to the team. That is really cool and funny. Yeah. But anyways, you get the point, right? And so these agents, oh my goodness gracious. All this. Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm going to have to kill my Kaido. That's hilarious. But yeah, you get the point. So that's just one, yeah, really cool way. I would say you might find this really fascinating, especially with your AI security research or AI, yep, safety research, and specifically being in like the contract red team stuff. Yep. Actually, I'm going to tag the team. This is funny. Okay. So yeah, the other way that I was using AI in the last few days that I thought was really cool was basically, let me stop sharing, to create frames and payloads. This is not anything new, but basically to create frames and layered attacks for jailbreaking other models. So because Grok is like kind of so easy to jailbreak and willing to help with things that are malicious, mm-hmm, I've been using Grok to basically create payloads to do safety testing for Anthropic's models. And specifically, the frame for the attack was like a fictitious website, or if you wanted a fictitious book or whatever, sometimes you're trying to basically, yep, get it out of its security protections or its guardrails. And so you need like a back and forth that's like, make a recipe for Sudafed, right? And then it's like, oh, now let's actually make it more dangerous and more dangerous and, yep, more dangerous, right? Like you need this like back and forth. And so using models to kind of reconstruct that frame to really save a lot of time is super helpful. Yep. I've been using AI to, from like not a security perspective, but just from a building perspective, to build like little side projects. Like one of my, yep, you know, ones I'm most excited about is basically a soccer ranking thing for my good buddy who's like a high school soccer coach. And so like I'm really excited for it to like rank, you know, like local high school teams with like ELO and everything to kind of like predict which team, yeah, is better and how they're doing and all that. So I think that's really cool. And then I'm trying to think if there's anything else from like a security perspective that I'm doing. Where I'm a advisor for Ethiac, I consult them on their hackbot they're building, and I'm an advisor for Splick. So I consult them on their, like their AI safety stuff. And so, you know, getting to see kind of the hackbot side of things and then the safety testing side of things, like pretty fascinating and cool, but
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, and super cool to see the Kaido agent. Yeah, definitely feels like where the future is going is like, yeah, I don't know if we're at a kind of the fully autonomous stage, but certainly similar to, you know, how, yeah, you can now go and code much faster. It feels like that it is just going to come to security, to bug bounties, and make everyone work a whole lot faster.
Yeah, I don't think that it's going to be worth it to do what I just showed you on like every parameter on every tab, right? Like, yep, go find XSS. But what I do think will be really valuable is it's like, hey, I found this parameter and I know it does something weird here and I need to find like a bypass. Can you just try like every possible Unicode normalization pair? Can you try every special character in this thing? Yeah, exactly. And just like tell me which one's interesting and just like set it off to running. I think that is where it will really pay off in the short term. And then, you know, maybe long term we'll get something more like an autonomous hackbot. But yeah, and one thing that I think is really cool about Kaido, actually, this will be coming out sometime in a month or two. So this is like something that's worth thinking about. I'm sure you saw OpenAI just released their new agent thing. I actually just got access today. I haven't played with it yet, but that along with all these other companies are basically building browser use. Yep. And what's really neat about Kaido, which is not true for Burp, is that it is a website, right? But it's like basically a little web server. And so you can just tell these agents, like, especially if they're like local ones. So if you're, you know, what's the new one? It's Perplexity Comet or the Dia browser. Like if you're using browser use stuff like that, and these models are going to keep getting better at browser use, to use your, you know, use your own computer or whatever, or set up something, you can have Kaido just like boot it up. And these models can actually browse around in Kaido to do things. So you could, you know, have it actually take actions in Kaido to help you hack or to like set up some sort of hacking thing or whatever. So I think that's pretty cool. And a reason why I'm excited to be an advisor for Kaido, because I do think them being browser based is actually going to be a huge key differentiator. So
yeah, that's super exciting.
Cool, dude. Well, we really appreciate you coming on the pod, and I look forward to seeing you at DEF CON. And for anyone listening to this, heed Jack's words on what you should and shouldn't hack, and go promote your local governments, but also your company's VDP or VRP program if they don't have one. So cheers.
Exactly. Well, yeah, thank you.
Oh, actually, where can people find you, Jack? Yeah, where can people find you?
Awesome. Yeah, I'm on, you know, Twitter, Jack H. Cable, LinkedIn as well. I'll be around DEF CON as well.
Awesome. Thanks. See ya.
Great.
Peace.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for watching to the end, y'all. If you want more Critical Thinking content, or if you want to support the show, head over to ctbb.show/discord. You can hop in the community. There's lots of great high-level hacking discussion happening there, on top of masterclasses, hackalongs, exclusive content, and a full-time hunter's guild if you're a full-time hunter. It's a great time. Trust me. All right. I'll see you there.